Good to see each one here this morning. I appreciate the chance to speak this morning. We're going to be in chapter 14, starting in verse 25, once I kind of bring everyone up to speed again. I've mentioned every so often in this series that when you preach through a whole book, you end up having to preach on things you would never preach about otherwise. And that's an advantage. And certainly this morning's lesson is like that. I would never just kind of flip the Bible open at random and say, I think I'll preach about Absalom's long hair. But we're going to talk about his long hair a little bit, not much, but and about Absalom's chariot and his 50 men that ran in front of him. Well, there are actually some lessons for us in this. For the last several chapters, we've been in a period of David's life that I'm sure he really wished he didn't have to go through. I'm sure over and over he thought back on that fateful night when he looked on his neighbor's wife and he wished he could have just said, no, I will not sin against my God. But he's paying the price now. God had told him back in chapter 12, verse 11 of 2 Samuel, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. Well, you can't get more household of David than his oldest son. And Absalom at this time is his oldest son. He didn't used to be, but Absalom killed the older brother, and so now he's the oldest son. And he's in this morning's lesson, he's going to try to become king. So that certainly is evil against him from his own household. And we've talked before about how God has this amazing ability to work with sinners to accomplish his purposes. God did not cause Absalom to be the sinner that he was. In fact, if anyone was to blame it, it would be David for not disciplining his children as he should have. God is not the one that tempted Absalom to decide he wanted to become king. And yet, clearly, this is the judgment from God. And David knew it. And when it happened, he knew full well why this was happening. It was what God said, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. And we don't know how God does this. And God is still doing it today. I don't know how he did it in David's life. I don't know how he does it today. I know that God does not tempt anyone to sin. And yet I also know that he has complete control over his creation. And so when Absalom rebelled against David, it was exactly what God purposed would happen to David. And that's what we're going to see in the lesson here. One of the things we're going to notice as we read about Absalom is that really he was behaving like a modern politician. In so many ways, he was just like that. And that's an important lesson, but it's not the most important lesson that we can get from this chapter. And I'm not going to really talk about politics. Because he was also behaving like a false teacher. False teachers and politicians are really very closely related. And false teachers are something we really do need to be concerned about. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus warned about false teachers. You know, beware of false prophets. Come to you in sheep's clothing. Inwardly, they're ravenous wolves. He didn't do that just so he could pad out the sermon. You know, it wasn't quite long enough. Yet he did that because he saw it was a serious danger to his people. And it really is. And too often people have a very casual attitude about false teachers. Oh, I can spot a false teacher. I bring my Bible to services with me. And when the preacher refers to a passage, I look it up. I am not going to be fooled by a false teacher. Baloney. That's just baloney. Do you look up all the passages he didn't quote? Because oftentimes a false teacher does his work by what he doesn't say much more than what he does say. So we'll be talking about a false teacher some in the lesson this morning. And really, false teachers succeed in what they do for much the same reasons that Absalom succeeded. And everything we read about Absalom in this morning's lesson, he was successful. The guy's certainly bold, and he got away with it. You ever heard the phrase someone that got away with murder? Absalom literally got away with murder. He murdered his brother, Amnon. And in our previous lesson, we read about how Joab arranged for David to bring his son back. Unpunished. He never paid a price for what he did to Amnon. We'll watch how that plays with the people in this morning's lesson. Well, I'm not going to read the whole section at a time. I'm going to read a few verses and then we'll talk about it. So we'll start in chapter 14, verse 25, and I'll read 25 through 27. Now in all Israel was no one as handsome as Absalom, so highly praised, from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him. When he cut the hair of his head, and it was at the end of every year that he cut it, for it was heavy on him, so he cut it, he weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels by the king's weight. To Absalom there were born three sons and one daughter whose name was Tamar. She was a woman of beautiful appearance. Absalom was just the perfect celebrity. And in fact, this first verse I read, it really reminds us of Saul back in 1 Samuel 9, verse 2, about how he was the most handsome guy around. And, you know, he didn't become the best king of all. Absalom's following in his steps. And not just Absalom, but his whole family. I mean, his daughter, his beautiful daughter, you know. So that's a celebrity family. People like celebrity families, you know. Man's good looking. His wife's good looking. His kids are good looking. This is just great. People like that. In fact, this says in verse 25, so highly praised. Yeah, who's praising him? Well, the people. People praise. Oh, you know that Absalom? You know, he's next in line to be king. And wow, is he good looking? And his family, what a lovely family that he's got. No defects. It specifically says, from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him. Wow, wouldn't you like to have no defects? Of course, it didn't mention spiritual defects. This is just physical. But I think most of us, we would look a little bit different if we had no defects. I know I would. Morally, he was really messed up. But hey, he didn't look it. He looked great. Morally, he's a murderer. But hey, the people are willing to overlook that. He's a good-looking guy. He's got a good-looking family. Just charming. So that's up to date. I mean, modern Americans like movie stars that are good-looking. They like politicians that are good-looking. Now, you know, you got to have more than just good looks. You know, you have to have some charisma, charm. Absalom had that, as we're going to see. Do you think a really ugly person could be elected president today? I don't think so. I mean, I know in history we've had some. Probably the most ugly we had was Abraham Lincoln. Very well known as an ugly guy. But back then, they weren't putting a guy's picture on TV every night. So, and he wasn't being elected that way. So Absalom, he had the looks. He had the image. He really had the qualifications to be a modern politician. And he was an Israelite politician, as we will see. He was also vain. Did you notice that? He's got this long hair. Once a year he cuts it and he weighs it. Why is he doing that? Because he thinks a lot of himself. Yeah. How much do you think it'd weigh if I cut my hair once a year? That's probably why I don't. But you know, being vain didn't affect his popularity. People didn't look and say, "Do you see that Absalom? How vain. Isn't that disgusting?" They didn't say that. No. He was highly praised. "You see that Absalom? He cut his hair. You know how much that hair weighed? I can't believe that. Wow, a beautiful head of hair he's got. And his family." I mean, just, that's the way they would talk. In fact, the story in the next chapter, and we will get into a little bit into the next chapter this morning, it's really about Absalom's ego. And we see his ego right here with this. Now, I want to mention one really odd thing about this paragraph I read. Just imagine cutting this paragraph out of the chapter. And would you lose anything? You would never notice it was missing. I mean, someone could take these three verses out. You could read from verse 24 to verse 28, and you would never miss these verses. Why are they there? Well, I've already told you they're partly there to warn us about politicians. But much more, those verses describe an awful lot of modern church leaders. They describe what people are looking for with modern church leaders. Now, if you take the most successful, and I'm using the term in the world sense, the most successful modern church leaders, the mega church leaders, by and large, these people are good-looking and charismatic. And that's what people want in a leader. And a lot of them are just like Absalom. They've got image and they don't have faith. And I've mentioned a number of times before, but I've got to keep mentioning this. This is so critical. When we pick people to be our leaders, we have to judge them based on something different than do they look nice and do they sound nice. Well, turn over to 1 Timothy chapter 3, and here's where God gives us His qualifications for a church leader. This is 1 Timothy 3 is talking about the qualifications of an elder, an overseer. So in verse 2, "An overseer then must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, but gentle, peaceable, free from the love of money. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? And not a new convert, so that he will not become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. And he must have a good reputation with those outside the church, so that he will not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil." Now, brethren will read this and they say, "Well, that's the qualifications for an elder. We don't have that for a preacher." Well, what do you have for a preacher? "Oh, well, we don't have anything." And they act like that. And they'll hire a preacher without looking at any of these qualifications. You'll bring a man in, and I've seen this done, who's children are rebellious. They are not interested in the Lord's church. The father raised them, and that's the way they ended up. And yet, we want this guy. Well, what are the qualifications for the guy? He can preach a good sermon. That's what his qualifications are. One of my brothers years ago was applying for a preacher job, and they just had to mail a cassette tape of his sermon to him. I'm sure they eventually interviewed him, but the first thing, we'll listen to your tape, and if we like it, then we'll call you in. Yeah, it's all about performance. You know, does the guy do a good job up in the pulpit? And all these things. Notice it never said what the guy looks like, you know, for an elder. Doesn't say how charming his family is or anything like that. It does say he needs to have a family of faith. I think these verses are in the Bible as a warning. Absalom pulled the wool over the eyes of the people of Israel, partly because he was good looking. And we got to be careful about that. So let me read the next section, verses 28 through 33. This is back to 2 Samuel 14. Now, Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem and did not see the king's face. Then Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but he would not come to him. So he sent again a second time, but he would not come. Therefore he said to his servants, "See, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire." So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Then Joab arose, came to Absalom at his house, and said to him, "Why have your servants set my field on fire?" Absalom answered Joab, "Behold, I sent for you, saying, 'Come here, that I may send you to the king to say, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me still to be there. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face. And if there is iniquity in me, let him put me to death.'" So when Joab came to the king and told him, he called for Absalom. Thus he came to the king and prostrated himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. So Absalom is complaining to Joab that there's no... What was the reason for him even to come back from Geshur? He was in Geshur to keep from getting put to death because he was a murderer. And Joab got David to agree to bring him back, and Joab actually personally went to Geshur, brought him back. But for 2 years he hasn't been allowed to see David. David said, "No, he's not allowed to see my face. Let him stay in his house." So Absalom put up with that for 2 years and says, "Enough's enough. Let's have this thing out." So he's got to have Joab. You know, Joab can go to the king. Joab doesn't want to come. I don't know why. I mean, Joab was the guy that originally brought him back from Geshur, but apparently he's done enough for Absalom. So Absalom sends word and he doesn't come. He's not interested in helping him. So he sets Joab's field on fire. Yeah. We all laugh when that happens. I mean, that was obviously a sin. I mean, but don't you know the people of Israel laughed when they heard about that? I mean, this did not detract from Absalom's popularity as a politician. Oh, that Absalom. You know what he did today? He set Joab's field on fire. Joab came then. That's the way the people reacted, I'm sure. And wow, he got his way. I mean, we read this and we say, you know, Absalom, you're really pushing it here. He's saying, "Let me see the king's face. If there's iniquity in me, I'll die." Hey, was there iniquity in him? He's a murderer. And he's saying, "I want to go see David and let's have it out. If I'm guilty, I'll die. Otherwise, I should be allowed to see my dad, the king." So, you might say he's a little bit reckless, but in fact, this was a very calculated risk. David had never come anywhere near punishing one of his sons. Absalom was confident he could pull this off, and he did. David accepted it, you know, and then he bowed down to the king. The king kissed him. Everything's okay. Well, externally. It's all with Absalom, it's all an act. You know, he's not kissing his dad because he's loyal to him. So It's interesting how God is using David himself to accomplish David's punishment. Had David done what the law said he should do, he's the judge of all the land. You know, you shall not let a murderer live. You shall not accept a ransom for the murderer. You shall surely put to death the murderer. If he had done what the law said, he wouldn't have all the grief that's going to come over the next several chapters. But David's brought this on himself. God's going to use that to spank him for what he's done. All right. Well, we've got six more verses to do that I want to cover this morning. And then we've got to talk about it a little bit. Now, it came about after this that Absalom provided for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men as runners before him. I just realized we've got more than six verses, so we'll have to wait a little bit longer. I'm just going to read six right now. Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate, and when any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And he would say, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel." And then Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king." Moreover, Absalom would say, "Oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land. Then every man who has any suit or cause could come to me, and I would give him justice." And when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, he would put out his hand to take hold of him and kiss him. In this manner, Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. All right, so there's two things going on here, but they're very closely related. First of all is the chariot. I don't know if his dad had a chariot or not. I mean, in a city the size of Jerusalem, you do not need a chariot. A chariot's not going to help you very much. And what about this 50 men as runners before him? I mean, it's like he's got a secret service group here. And that's what he's trying to look like. He's trying to look like one of the kings of the nations around. So, I mean, you can just imagine. I mean, whenever Absalom goes out to take a ride around town, these 50 guys are running in front, "Make way for Prince Absalom." And then that, along comes the chariot, you know, he's got his long hair streaming behind him in the wind. Everyone is thinking, "Oh, wow, look at that. Isn't that a great Prince Absalom? You know, he's the oldest son of King David. He's going to be the next king. Oh, wow, it'll be great when he's king. Look at that." So he's still doing the PR thing. It's all about appearances. And then he did some more politicking here. Now, you know, a modern politician, he has to go eat at one of these hunter's breakfasts. You get up early and go eat at a hunter's breakfast, and you wear your flannel coat and all that, so you look like a hunter. And well, Absalom, they didn't have hunter's breakfast, I don't guess, but he would get up early. Because there would be people who were on a certain day, they would go and see the king for judgment. So he would meet them on their way. "Hey there, hey, where are you from?" "Oh yeah, from the tribe of Dan or whatever." "Oh yeah. What are you here for?" "My neighbor has moved my boundary marker, and I can't get justice. I've got to get something done here." "Oh really? Oh well, your case is right. You deserve justice. You're right. And unfortunately, there's nobody to hear your case. You know, I wish I was appointed a judge. You know, I'd make sure everyone got justice." And the next guy comes along. "You know, oh, where are you from?" "I'm from the tribe of Dan." "Oh, yeah. What's your case?" "My neighbor is saying I moved his boundary marker." "Oh, really? That's terrible. Well, your case is right. I wish I was a judge and I could make sure you got justice." So, nobody would ever have a wrong case as far as Absalom was concerned. Have you ever known of a politician to do anything other than that? I mean, no politician is going to campaign saying, "Folks, if you elect me, things are going to get tougher. I'm going to have to raise taxes. They're just too low at this point." And the government is just spending too much money handing it out. I'm going to have to cut that back, folks. And you know, you've gotten used to getting all these checks from the government. It's not going to happen after I get elected. Well, guess what? You won't get elected. So Absalom is promising the impossible. Everybody's case is right. But it says he stole the hearts of the men of Israel. He pulled it off. They believed him. And just like a modern politician, see, Absalom is campaigning as an outsider, you know. I'm outside the Washington Beltway, you know. I'll come in here and I'll clean it all up. Of course, he was just as much inside as anybody else, and he was going to live just like anyone else. Well, who's he running against? He's running against his dad, you know, the guy he bowed down to and kissed in the previous chapter. He's a big hypocrite. And then, this is great. You know, he's been talking to the guy for a while, and the guy comes to bow down to him because, you know, he's the prince. He's going to be the next king. Oh, no. You know, you're my brother. Oh, that Absalom, you know, he's just such a calm guy. You know, he doesn't put on any airs. You know, isn't he great? Conveniently forgetting, this is the guy that hired 50 runners to go in front of his chariot. Calm a guy, my foot. But that's the way he's pretending to be. And so he's going to get elected. You know, his political tricks are working. Did he really care about these people that much that were coming to get judgment? He cared nothing about them. No. They were just tools to get him elected. Now, they didn't have elections like we have today, but it'll work the same way. We have the same thing going on today, and it's not just politicians. It's people that would guide our souls in the wrong direction. We have to be aware of this, that you can't just believe the first thing someone says. These things can be nothing more than an act. All right, so now this is the last reading, verses 7 through 12. Now it came about at the end of 40 years that Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go and pay my vow which I vowed to the Lord in Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow while I was living at Geshur in Aram, saying, 'If the Lord shall indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord.' The king said to him, 'Go in peace.' So he arose and went to Hebron. But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, 'As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom is king in Hebron.' Then 200 men went with Absalom from Jerusalem, who were invited and went innocently, and they did not know anything. And Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city Gilo, while he was offering the sacrifices. And the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom." Now, this says at the end of 40 years, which is clearly a mistake. David only reigned for 40 years. So some of the translations will change this to 4 years, which is as good a guess as any, I guess, for what the number was originally. But look at what Absalom has done in just a few years like this. He has succeeded in turning the people's hearts away from his dad and to him. I mean, David was this great king who had killed Goliath, who had conquered the Philistines, who had given the people peace on every side, winning all the Lord's battles for them. I'm sure the people were much more prosperous than they had been in the days of Saul, because you've got all this peace, you don't have to worry about paying tribute to any other foreign nation. But hey, we want Absalom. Why do they want Absalom? Well, he's young, he's good looking, he's charming, he's an ordinary guy, and he's going to give me justice. And besides, we're tired of David. We've had him a long time. Thank you. he mentions God. Notice that. He talks to his dad and says, I'd like to go to Hebron because I made a vow to God I would do that. Ever known a politician to bring up God? You got to bring up God. You know, that's the way you get elected. How much did Absalom care about God? Zero. He didn't care about God. This is just a cover for his ambition. He's just using his sacrifices to God as a cover to go to Hebron. So here he is. He's plotting to kill his dad. He's plotting to kill the king that God had anointed to be king. But he's going to Hebron to offer sacrifices because he made a vow to God. Wow. Now, Hebron was actually the place where his dad had been anointed king. So there was a logical... It was a good choice for him if he's going to get anointed king. He was born in Hebron. He was born back when his dad was king, you know, just over Judah. And we read in verse 12, the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. So, you know, he's winning the election, right? Now think about this. These people know how things work. They know that if Absalom becomes king, David's not going to be king anymore. What's going to happen to him? There's only one thing that ever happens to a king that gets ousted in a coup. He gets killed. If you leave the guy alive, he's going to come back and take over and kill you. It's you or him. Those people knew that. All these people that are kind of going into the ballot box and, you know, checking the mark for Absalom, they know that means David gets killed. Where is their conscience? What is going on here? God is using the sins of the people as well to judge David. Well, you know, a democracy is the best form of government. If you let everybody vote, then you'll have only good people elected, right? These people elected Absalom. He had the majority of the votes. And the choice was between him and the guy that God had anointed to be king. No, we'll kill him. We want this new guy. Wow. Well, I want to say a few more things about guarding against false teachers. To me, that's just a very critical issue. I've mentioned before, I've known a number of preachers who were false teachers over the years, and they've all done damage. This chapter, I think, has a warning about that. One of the warnings is we've got to guard against being deceived by worldly greatness. And we need to be warned against the attraction to gain worldly greatness. The politician that wants to get people's votes, he looks like he's successful in the eyes of the world, and he promises he'll make you successful too. And the two go right together. And the false teacher is doing the same thing. He looks the part. He looks successful, charming. And in one way or another, he shaves what he's preaching to fit what he knows you want. That's why I was saying earlier, you know, you take your Bible and listen, and everything he preaches is from the Bible. But have you noticed what he doesn't preach? That's where the preacher does the damage. In leaving out the things that he thinks would not be so popular. You're not going to like that. There was one that I knew before I knew he was a false preacher. He'd preach a sermon, and I talked to him afterwards. I said, I don't believe that. I think you've misunderstood the scriptures. Well, it was a controversial topic. And, you know, I wasn't going to beat up on him because he took a different view, but Interesting enough, he never taught on that topic again. And that's exactly the way a false teacher will do it. If it's going to offend people, why should he preach about that? He's not in there to help you. He's in there because he likes the position for himself. Why do people get deceived by these worldly things? Why do people get deceived by good looks? Because their values are distorted. That's why. Because they have been deceived and think good looks are what matter. And so they get deceived when the politician or the false teacher comes along with the good looks. Why are people deceived by flattery? I mean, this guy's flattering these people. They're coming to the king. Why are they deceived by that? Because of pride. Their own pride makes them believe the lies of the flatterer. If we could get rid of pride, flatterers wouldn't get anywhere with us. We would know better. Second point I want to make here about false teachers versus true teachers is we've got to learn what true greatness is. Politicians are feeding us a very false picture of what real greatness is about. Here's what Jesus said in Luke chapter 22. I'll start in verse 24, right before Jesus talks. This is Luke 22:24. And there arose also a dispute among them as to which one of them was regarded to be greatest. And he said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who have authority over them are called benefactors. But it is not this way with you, but the one who is the greatest among you must become like the youngest, and the leader like the servant. For who is greater, the one who reclines at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at the table? But I am among you as the one who serves." This was at the Last Supper, and when John tells the story of the Last Supper, he talks about Jesus washing the disciples' feet, which to them was scandalous. He was there as one who serves. And he's telling us today, if you want to be great, serve. It's not about sending 50 runners out in front of your chariot so everyone will know this great guy is coming. It's not a matter of weighing your hair every year so everyone will know how handsome you are. It's a matter of serving those who are in need. Now, I want to close with what Jesus called the fruit test. Turn over to Matthew chapter 7. I made reference to this earlier in the sermon, and I want to read what he says. This is Jesus' very, very serious warning about false prophets. And he tells us how to tell who they are. He says in Matthew 7, verse 15, "Beware of the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Grapes are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor figs from thistles, are they? So every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot produce bad fruit, nor can a bad tree produce good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. So then you will know them by their fruits." Okay, we obviously have to do a little bit of translating here, because what does Jesus mean by knowing them by their fruits? Let me suggest that since this is coming at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, a really good fruit test would be just to ask, is this man living by the principles that are found in the earlier parts of the sermon? Is he obeying the Sermon on the Mount? That will tell you what kind of fruit he has. And that earlier parts in the sermon address things like attitude toward money, whether the guy is a show-off, whether the guy gets angry with people that cross him. All these things are found in this sermon. there's lots of fruit that can be looked at and analyzed to ask the question, is this guy the real deal or not? Jesus says, a good tree can't bear bad fruit. If you're finding problems with this guy, his life is not matching up to what you know the character of a Christian ought to be, then that's the warning right there. Look at the elegance of this. A lot of people think that to know a false teacher, you have to be an expert on the Bible. You've got to know all the ins and outs of all the interesting questions so you can find out whether the guy's teaching the truth or not. If that was the case, most Christians would not be able to handle that. But Jesus made it a lot simpler. Just look at his fruit. Look at the kind of life he's living. Now, when Paul talked about qualifications for elders, he said, look at the man's children, which is also a fruit of his life. Even a brand new Christian knows right from wrong and can tell if something's wrong with someone. Now, the sad thing is, if you sit at the feet of a false teacher for very long, your values are going to get warped to go along with his. And there are some of these mega churches out there with preachers whose characters are just so obviously off. And yet it doesn't matter. The people are going to have this guy no matter what. A few years back, there was one of those mega preachers that got himself in the news by asking his congregants if each family would just donate $1,000, I could buy myself a private jet. And of course, the journalists had a heyday with this. This was just hilarious. It did not faze his congregation. They had gotten adapted to the values of this false teacher. And I expect their values were much the same by that time. Money matters a lot for them, just like it mattered to the megachurch head. So my prayer is that God will guard us, guide us, and help us to judge rightly between the true and the false. Turn away from our pride and our foolishness so that we're not fooled by the flatterer as those people were by Absalom. I pray that he will give us men who will truly bear good fruit, and that in our own lives we too will bear good fruit. Let's stand, we'll have a final prayer, and then we'll be dismissed.